Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Community Geek Podcast. I am Gregory Russo, here joined by Richard Millington.
Good evening.
How are you guys doing out there? It's been a while. So, first things first, we've got quite a few new members that I want to give a bit of a shout-out to. We've got Beth Sorty, David Adams, Tashina Combs, Peter Button, Anya Shirakova, and, of course, the Hawk, Sarah Hawk, who, believe it or not, has access to a discourse forum, and, oh my goodness, can't wait to probe her brain about all that good stuff. Because as far as I know, she's the only person in Community Geek that actually has been invited into the beta.
Which one is she using?
I think she's just using, like, a real bare-bones...
It's SitePoint.
Yeah.
I can see this. It actually looks good.
It looks interesting. It's very... I was surprised most by, like, how fluid everything feels. It's very modern, minimalistic. There's a lot of white space. There's not a lot of borders or dividing things, but yet everything is easily organized, and everything drops down and flows very nicely. It's a very pleasant experience to look at.
Discourse is like... It's one of those technologies that a lot of us are very excited about. And there are lots of things that it doesn't have going for it in terms of the stats, in terms of the integration, in terms of the limited accessibility, at least right now. But what it does have is a technology platform that all the other forum platforms over the last 10 years should have invented, but they didn't. In terms of innovation on the forum side, we have Vanilla that are doing something that looks, it looks good. We have Moot, which is kind of more of a discus thing, but could be formed as well. And then we have Discourse, which are embedding every modern technology in the way that forums work. And it's doing it in such a clever way. They have an amazing technological team. I think that Jeff Atwood, the guy that heads up their team, is amazing, and his work at Stack Exchange was amazing. They're just one of those platforms that I cannot believe that we're only getting to now. Right? But I think we're around a year or maybe 2 years away from the point where this really begins to take off. But we certainly looked at it when we were developing the Community Geek site. We have looked at it on behalf of clients. And if we just had one or two more things, I think we'd be recommending this to a lot of our clients at the moment.
Well, real quick before we move on, since we're talking about it, like, what do you, if you could only add two features to it to make it the perfect thing, what would it be?
Stats. I think it's very weak on stats, and it only works with the very latest versions of the browser. So we had one client a couple of months ago who I think would have been perfect for this. But the challenge they had is that they are on kind of old systems. It's one of these big companies that takes a while to change or update their Internet Explorer or their Chrome or their Firefox. And so it wasn't compatible with Discourse. So it was an internal community, which is such a shame because it would have worked so incredibly well. So what we ended up doing was using the existing, I think it was MyBB and MyBB forums, and adopting that to look as much like Discourse as possible. And the result was actually really, really good. But, you know, it just wasn't Discourse. It wasn't supported in the way that Discourse is. And it doesn't have the team behind it that Discourse has. Mm. So definitely the stats and probably better integration with existing systems.
Yeah, I've heard that browser thing from a few people that work in large companies now. It blows my mind considering how easy it is to update browsers. But I've never been in that environment. So I assume there's a whole new set of challenges to it. But it's like, I don't know, every time you close it and open it, Chrome updates itself. I don't know.
Seems yeah,
like maybe you should catch your company up.
I think it's difficult for a lot of... I mean, I do understand how easy it is to look in from the outside and say, why aren't you updating this? But I think the challenge is that if you are a big company and you are very risk-averse and you've got a lot of security risks, then having something where you have a deal with a specific company, where you can get backup and support anytime you want, where you can sue a company if they really make a mistake. I think those things are very important. So whilst it would be very easy to say, well, you should just update all of your technology, it's so easy. The reality is very different on the ground, I think. I mean, these people that work in these technological departments are not idiots at all, but they have certain restraints that are there for a reason. Mm. And a lot of time, and with a lot of the work that we do, we have to work within those restraints. And I've hired people in the past who used to say, well, you just need to do something. And then they'll highlight something that the company just can't do. And they can't work within that restraint. But that's where the real creativity happens within the space. So I think that discourse will be popular in time. It'll either be that the browsers catch up and everyone has updated, or it'll be that they'll make their platform more compatible with previous internet browsers. But we'll see which one it is.
All right, getting into our first story of the show, we've got some key takeaways from ForumCon 2014 posted by one of our community geeks, Jessica Malnick.
I love her.
She is great.
She was amazing at ForumCon. I mean, I didn't know what she looked like, and we were sitting on the same table, and it's one of those situations where you're like, oh, so you're her. yeah, like, she's a really amazing person.
Yeah, she's really friendly, very active on the site, and I thought her takeaways were fairly insightful. So while we were lucky enough to have you here on the show for one of these casts, we know that you travel a lot, so you're not an everyday guest host with me, but you're certainly my favorite. I wanted to have you talk about these takeaways because they're pretty good, and they cover a lot of things that people on the Community Geek Forum have been talking about sort of indirectly, but it sort of brings it all into one place. So the first one is adopt lean startup principles when building your community from the ground up. And the focus here is on developing a minimum viable community. She has this bold italicized.
So this is from the Eric Ries book, the Lean Startup Movement. And David Spinks, the guy that runs CMX, that like gave this talk, was terrific on stage. He gave a great introduction, and you can find his talk on YouTube as well. So what happened with this talk is that the point that David was trying to make was that you need to make sure that your community is solving a issue. And it's similar to the point that I made later in the day as well. And you can do a lot of things to test your talk, your concept for that community, your idea for that community before you even launch it. And David Spinks went through the different strategies behind that. He also looked at how you can build a sense of community among those members as well. It was a great talk, and I recommend that you check it out. It's also David Spinks' birthday today, so I'd like to wish him a happy birthday.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I caught a podcast with him on The Web Psychologist. He's really terrific.
Yeah.
So, yes, happy birthday, David. She also mentions Justin Esaf, and I wanted to know if you agreed with this as, like, this is a good technique or a litmus test. If you can start a Twitter chat around your topic, then that's a good sort of indication that you have enough interest to go forward. Do you think that's enough? Because it strikes me as sort of a weak test.
I think it's better than nothing, and I think it's more than what most organizations would be willing to do. But I think it's better to try and start a mailing list around that topic, or just a groupy email that goes around to different members of your target audience to get a feel for whether this is something that has more than one issue that you can discuss. So if you read what the Stack Exchange guys are doing and the issues that they have, what you see is that these people, or there are lots of people that create a site on their Area 51 network, but then it has an initial burst of activity, and then it flames out really quickly. So while Justin's thing I think is good, it's good for it because every single company can apply it. I think it's far better to at least have it in a mailing list or some sort of mailing group. So then you can see if you can have more than one discussion, if it's something that has legs and grows and develops. Yeah,
that's fair. I would say, I mean, not that I'm the most community, I'm not even the most community expert guy on this podcast, but I would say try to start a few Twitter chats about it. See if you can keep the same people engaged for more than one day. If you can keep it going for like a week or two, then I would say, yeah, you got it. But I mean, Twitter is so fast and ethereal, like, if you just do one event, like, for a couple hours, try to get people talking about it, you probably could get them talking about nearly anything. But if you can sustain that, I think that's a really good sign. But of course, it's not enough to just have the topic. You also have to tap into a motivation. And I know from reading your books, Richard, this is something you are extremely keen on. And in fact, she cites you for talking about it. You have to base your community on an existing motivation, something psychological, something emotional, that strikes to like the fundamental reasons why people do anything.
So what we're talking about here are generally the BJ Fogg motivations, which is the key things why people tend to do anything. Not always, but generally speaking, are because they want some pleasure in some particular form. They want to reduce the pain they have in their lives. They hope to change something, or they're worried that something will change or something will happen to them, the fear. Or they want to be included amongst a group of people they consider their peers, or they're worried of being excluded by a group that they're already within. So most of the actions we take are to resolve one of those six motivations. And so if you can have your community concept based upon one of those motivations, you're far more likely to see that it takes off and it becomes a kind of community that's sticky. A kind of community when people hit that group, they stick to that group and they become regular active members of that group.
For those that don't follow your blog, which of these have you found to be the most effective?
So we did some research on this a while ago, and we found that social inclusion, that idea of having a community that's exclusive, is typically the most popular. It has like a 37% conversion rate or something along those lines. Not always, but that seems to be the case. So I would go with that.
By the way, if you're listening to the show and you're not following Richard's blog, what are you doing? Go to feverbee.com and start adding that to your feeds, because he puts out pretty much daily posts of extremely high quality. This is sort of related to the first point, I think, in a lot of ways. Number three, use purposeful design principles in your community. You have to answer the question, you exist to do or solve what, and then build your site and your philosophy, your vision, your culture around that question. And that helps reinforce things, because affordances, user experience, the sort of informal UI design that comes with how people structure their language and interactions that may not have anything to do with technology, but do have a lot to do with how you're defining your community culture. These all have extremely significant impacts on how your community develops as it goes on.
Yeah, Courtney's talk, it wasn't one that I had a chance to see, unfortunately, whilst I was there. But Courtney is the person behind Moot, the platform that we mentioned before. But I think his ideas seem to make sense. They don't seem particularly complex in any particular way. One of the things that that Jessica does write here, which I'm very interested in discussing, is the idea of lurkers versus participants. And I think it's something that she got from my talk, or at least something that I suggested in there. And the point I was trying to make is that whilst every single one of us can think of a time when a lurker became a regular participant, I can't think of a single community professional in the whole world right now that has converted more than 5% of their lurkers into regular participants. Which means that all this time and effort that we spend trying to get lurkers to participate is a waste of time. Because the idea that lurkers, they'll lurk around, they'll learn the rules of the community, and then they participate is bunk. It's being disproven by IBM, it's being disproven by Brian Butler, it's being disproven by a few people. There are studies that show that this generally doesn't happen. People either don't participate because they weren't engaged right at the beginning, or their level of interest in that topic is not really that high. So we can't do a lot about the interest in a topic. We can make sure that the community is very much based upon existing motivation, which would help. But what we can do is that we can take all this time that we're using to convert locals into participants and instead trying to engage the newcomers when they arrive in the community, because that is going to be a far bigger win. Now, I'm not saying it's not possible to convert a lurker into a regular participant. If you spend enough time doing that, I'm sure that you will succeed. It's just not the best use of your time. Everything that you spend time doing has an opportunity cost to it. So the point here is to make sure that we're trying to engage the new contributors in the community, not the lurkers. The lurkers are happy as they are. We don't have to do anything about them. We can pretty much ignore the lurkers. They're going to be very happy just doing what they are. But it's the new contributors, the people that we can convert into regular active members, that most need our attention. So it's this group that we want to spend our time on.
Yeah, I mean, speaking from personal experience, when I was working on the CSM with CCP, it's the Council of Stellar Management. CCP is a game company. They run a extremely large, vibrant virtual world that has... It is a massive community, a very active community. It has a lot of sub-communities in it. And these sub-communities will often group together electorally, because CCP put it in place, a place where they can directly elect community representatives. Typically, they're elected by blocks. Every election, there's always 2, 3, sometimes 5 candidates that will run on some kind of platform of trying to engage the silent majority, this massive group of people in the community that are not really participating, not very engaged, aka the lurkers. They do not do well. I think one candidate has managed to really tap into that in the entire history of them doing it, and it's been like 6 years. It just doesn't happen. And even developmentally, in terms of their design process, CCP often invests massive resources, massive time into trying to get people more engaged in the community. For good reason, if they are more engaged, they tend to stay longer. And I think that's a motivation for a lot of people in the community space. We want people to be forming these relationships that'll keep them invested in the community long after the initial reason they went there has faded from their mind. But that's not really the way it works.
Well, if you can socialize people in the community very early on, and by that, I mean, if you can get them to interact with other people in that group, if you can get them to disclose some information about themselves very early on, from the moment that they join, in fact, their first contribution should be a self-disclosure-based discussion where they reveal some information about themselves, not an introduce yourself thread, because these things tend to have no impact whatsoever and tend to drive people away as well, but to have a sort of discussion where people can reveal information about themselves, find that reciprocated, then they're far more likely to become regular active members of the community. And that's what we want to be building very early on. That's where we want to be in the space.
All right. We've got two more here. Last one we'll get to in a second. Before that, content is king. This is a short one, but I think a little bit undervalued. She says, your community is only as valuable as the content that is shared in there. Encourage members to share high-quality content. I don't think that's entirely right. You're also as valuable as the people you have there and the relationships that they're building. But content is very important. You've got to give people a reason to come back, to sustain them until they build those relationships that are sort of self-generating at that point. And you've also got to have good content if you want to bring in new people. And if you figure that content also extends to original posts and replies and discussions like that, you need to have active, vibrant discussions, or people will just talk to their friends away from your site, which is good in terms of keeping your community together, very bad in terms of keeping your community site alive.
Well, I don't care at all about a community site. I mean, it's best that people talk wherever they want to talk, wherever makes the most sense to them. And in fact, a lot of the issues that people have is that they build a big, expensive site, they realize that it's far easier just to do the same thing on a Facebook or LinkedIn or on Twitter, and that's perfectly fine. What I think we're talking about here is content is a useful tool, but not in a way that most people think it is. Most people try to create communities where you're sharing content, which is the latest news, but it's just stuff that's being rewritten from other sites. And the best content for a community, as we often say, is content about the community. It's content about what people in that community are doing. That's exactly the kind of content that we most want to read, more than anything else, because it's content that is only unique to us, that no one else has. And it means that we're not competing with the very sites that we want to be promoting the work that we do. I don't like when you hear in talks and someone says, you have to encourage your members to share high quality content. Because to me, that strikes me as everyone there thinking, what do you think I'm trying to do? I mean, am I not trying to get my members to share high quality content? What would be more interesting are the specific tactics that you can take to get members to do that. And that's one of the challenges I think we see at a lot of talks as well, where the advice is good, but generic. It's not specific enough to be practical. It's not something that we can do. It's like saying, encourage your members to interact with one another, which makes perfect sense. But that's what we're all trying to do anyway. What we need is a deeper level of discussion than that, which is a level of discussion where we're talking about how we get people to participate, how we get the specific practical things that we can take away and then apply immediately to our community.
Yeah, it's not super useful to, okay, just make your content interesting. Oh, okay. Make it gooder.
Yeah.
It needs to be about 20% cooler.
Okay, so what do we have the last one? Jeff Atwood. I love Jeff Atwood.
Yeah, Ian, he says lead by example.
He's one of the smartest minds in the community space. His work at Stack Exchange was amazing. His work at Discourse is amazing. He's a doer amongst doers. I mean, he gets stuff done like no one I've ever seen, and he has that ability to form teams incredibly well. I really wish that he would write a book because I think he's a genius. But he's one of those people that walks that great divide between the community space and the programming space. So he knows exactly what people want, and he has that community experience to actually do it. He has that engineering background to actually do it, to create the thing that people most want.
That's a powerful combination.
Yeah, so when he's saying lead by example, again, I missed his talk because, frankly, I was watching the World Cup game. What I think he's trying to say here is that you basically have to showcase the behavior you want members to do. I think that sometimes works, but I don't think that community guidelines have any impact upon the community. And in fact, we know they don't because we've tested this. We've removed the guidelines from communities and counted the number of complaints and the number of issues that people had to resolve. And it was pretty much the same. The people that read the guidelines of a community aren't the people that tend to break them. Because if you're the kind of person that takes the time to read the guidelines, then you're not going to break them. You're just not that kind of person because you actually care what the rules are. The people that break the guidelines are a different type of person and they're not going to read them. That's why having community guidelines is a useful thing, but only because it helps you and your moderators set the right actions for you and your team. You know how to deal with the different issues that tend to arise.
I think Jeff's talking about something a little different here. He's not talking so much about having guidelines for the members, but more having your community management team behave like you would want an ideal member to behave, such sort of like you're hoping that they'll imprint upon you. Like if you see a community manager posting in a certain way, interacting in a certain way, that members will be more inclined to follow suit or take the same tone.
Sure, but then I'm not sure that will work particularly well. The problem with that approach is that in some communities that might make sense, and in Stack Exchange that might make sense, sharing high quality information, for example. But then you get the communities that aren't based around sharing information. Communities where members most just want to have fun and to relax. I mean, if the members of, say, Reddit acted like the moderators did, the personality of that community would completely die. Because the members have the freedom to act a certain way, but the expectations of the moderators is to be above that. It's the same, it's like saying, I can't think of a relevant example, but the personalities of the two groups are very different. And there'll be lots of times where they don't overlap, where the things that you expect from moderator are very different from the things that you expect from members. And if you try to change the behavior of those members, even by showing the behavior that you want, you could stamp out the very personality of that community.
There is a very interesting corollary, though, now that you've mentioned Reddit. A lot of ways that subreddits tend to die is that the moderators start to behave, how should I phrase it? Not antisocially, but sort of against the culture of the subreddit. Every subreddit is a little bit different. All the moderators have slightly different styles. Like you said, they are held to a slightly higher standard. But when that standard is not met, when the expectations of the moderator is not met and they behave not just like a normal member, because that can sometimes be, you know, that can sometimes be okay. But if they don't behave like a moderator and don't behave like other members in that subreddit, then that subreddit will turn on them very quickly. To the point of sometimes breaking apart completely and going elsewhere.
That's why I often think it's better for the community manager or the moderator to adopt the behavior that members are showing. To a certain extent, not always, but to reflect the personality of the members in that community more than anything else.
All right. We also have, I'm going to link this in the show notes. There's a literature review for those of you who are really interested in the lurker question and to what extent lurkers have a role in communities. I'm going to link the literature review, and I'm also going to link the discussion we're having on Community Geek about this. Dave Briggs started it, called Design for Lurkers, which has gotten quite a few posts. And we touched on a lot of the issues here, so I don't want to retread it necessarily, but the idea of how far you're supposed to go to try to engage this mass silent group, to what extent do you need to consider them when you're making site changes or making posts. And there's been quite a lot of feedback back and forth, including some really interesting things I would not recommend, Darren. But Jessica Melnick is coming there, Darren's coming there, I've been in there, David Adams, Anya, one of our new members, and they've all been going at it about, you know, can you completely ignore them? Should you completely ignore them? Obviously, I think Richard and I would agree it's a bit of a waste of time to chase after them. But, you know, to what extent do you need to keep them in mind when you're thinking about your activity, thinking about your content, thinking about your development? If that's interesting to you, check the show notes, click that link, participate, and give your feedback. And with that, I think we are going to close out this episode. Really want to thank Richard for taking time out of his busy schedule. I know he's in the middle of working on something, but he put that down to come onto the cast for you guys, and I really appreciate it. Every time Richard comes here, it's always a good show.
Bye.
Have a good week, everybody. See you soon.